and the staff seemed to feel it. It was a sensation to which many had grown accustomed. Situated on a leafy street a few blocks from Havana's rocky northern coast, La Fontana had opened in 1995 when authorities still investigated private restaurants for their numbers of tables and chairs. More than 12 could provoke a raid. Its clandestine feel, there was no sign outside, and a surrounding stone wall all but hid the restaurant from view, was part of a broader bid for its very survival, and it looked it. The Castro government had almost never regarded privatization kindly, granting business licenses only when economic forces compelled a drip of liberalizing reform. But in the aftermath of the Soviet collapse, a financial crisis had ensued. For decades, Cuba had relied on subsidies from Moscow. In their absence, it teetered on the brink of collapse. Absent his old Kremlin ally, Fidel looked inward for answers and reluctantly allowed a few private restaurants to surface in a fraught attempt to gin up local commerce. La Fontana's two owners, Horacio Reyes Lovio and Ernesto Blanco, were among the beneficiaries of the new tone and would soon become successful restaurateurs, a dangerous prospect in an island dominated by communist hardliners who spent their careers fending off Yankee capitalists. New concentrations of wealth were forming that could undermine the revolution, so the two businessmen kept their profiles low and were quietly, if not begrudgingly, allowed to thrive. Perhaps even government officials were loath to shut down one of the few haunts where they could still score a decent meal. By the time I arrived in Havana in June 2009, that old Paladar had been transformed into a favorite hangout for politicians, their staffs, and foreign business people alike. It was a place to eat, drink, and in my case, write, mostly from the vantage point of a still somewhat naive American journalist. A fixture there, I'd often scratch out pages alone atop one of the few polished wooden tables in back, filling a leather-bound notebook with run-on sentences, notes, and smears of blue ink. They were random observations mostly, a sort of blind attempt to piece together this confounding puzzle of a nation that I now called home. His approach, her look, their meeting, a dribble of insight that seeped through the censors of state-run newspapers. After a few months and what amounted to a few notebooks full of mostly useless pages, I'd gotten to know the restaurant's staff. One was Antonina. Her frankness and sharp tongue seemed matched only by her curiosity. It was the former that made us friends and the latter that would drive her to leave the island as a refugee. But before she did, her occasional rum-top whispers would help fill in my own knowledge gaps, chasms really, when it came to Cuba. Men like Ricardo Alarcón, then president of Cuba's National Assembly, were among La Fontana's well-heeled patrons who often chatted and sipped mojitos with a hearty crop of familiar faces. I'd try without much luck to listen in, attempting to discern with whom he was meeting and what they were discussing. Business could be conducted this way, and the eavesdropping went both ways. But tonight, my last night, I wondered why Antonina was so serious and to whom she had so subtly pointed. Passing behind me with a tray of empty glasses, she leaned into my ear. "That's Alejandro's," she whispered, brushing back the unkempt strands of raven-colored hair that dropped in front of her face. By Alejandro, Antonina had met Alejandro Castro Espin, a colonel within Cuba's powerful interior ministry and a member of the Castro family, whose inherent importance seemed to be outpacing much of the rest of the Castro clan. It was President Raul Castro's only son who now sat across from me at that bar. How could I have not realized that before? Of course, in November 2010, the extent of Alejandro's importance was not yet clear. He had yet to broker secret deals in Ottawa and Toronto with top Obama advisors Ben Rose and Ricardo Zuniga, nor he had presided over a spy-for-spy negotiation that would lay the groundwork for détente. What was clear was that Alejandro was already a player and a de facto top advisor to his father. More importantly, he was rumored to be gaining in power atop the senior echelons of the very agency tasked with Cuba's surveillance and counterintelligence. His ministry spied on journalists and dissidents alike, and by apparent coincidence, in my final hours in Cuba, he sat across from me, slouched over a beer. "Coño!" exclaimed Rafa, employing his favorite Cuban expletive, when I later told him of the encounter. Rafael, or Rafa for short, was a driver at CNN, and his eyes bulged as he pronounced just the ño in that typical Cuban habit of dropping whole syllables. Though he quickly recuperated, casually popped his shoulders, and gave me this simple, though at the time nonsensical, explanation. "This is Cuba." I had come to loathe that line, which by now was all